We present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In a few moments, Father Coughlin will come to the microphone to address you on the subject of Why Leave Your Own? These famous words of George Washington were adapted by Father Coughlin as he pleads with Catholic, Protestant, and Jew to support only those policies which are in harmony with best Americanism, and to forego such policies which will lead us into international war. Father Coughlin's office is still busy mailing out many thousands of the books which contain the first 9 addresses delivered over the radio this year. As speedily as possible, these volumes are being mailed. Every request will be fulfilled. At the close of this afternoon's address, Father Coughlin has a very important announcement to make. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Barcelona has fallen. This forecasts victory for the Christian forces of Franco and defeat for the communist-led troops of the Loyalists. For many months, unfortunately, the attention of Americans has been focused upon the European situation. To students of international affairs, it was evident that a victory for the Spanish communists would have definite repercussions in France, England, and in the United States. Had the Red Forces in Spain been victorious, the government of Daladier in France would have fallen, and a leftist regime under the leadership of Leon Blum would have risen to power. The Pacific administration of Neville Chamberlain would have given way to one headed by Leslie Hoar Belisha, the present Minister of War for Great Britain. As for the United States, an open alliance by this time would have been declared with these two radical administrations, which have as their advertised objective the destruction of Nazism in Germany and the preservation of democracy. Informed persons are aware, however, that their ultimate aim is to establish a modified form of communism. The ordinary American was not expected to piece together this crossword puzzle of international politics. However, he was conscious that a well-organized press was engaged in singing the praises of the loyalist communists and damning the endeavors of the Christian rebels in Spain. The ultimate objective for all this, I repeat, was not made clear until the last week, when the communist Daily Worker, a newspaper printed in New York, made manifest a hitherto suppressed document supporting the theory which I have just exposed. It was a pity in one sense that for the past 2 years our attention was engaged by the Spanish question, when we should have been busy solving our own national problems. Nevertheless, it was inevitable, for our local leftists and their supporters insisted upon forcing Spain upon us and making of Spain an American problem. Did they not publicly go about the United States enlisting young men for the Red Cause under the name of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade? Did they not collect huge sums of money from labor unions, church organizations, and many other social units for the enemies of Franco? And finally, were they not successful both in the press and in the cinema in stirring up propaganda to lift the embargo and thereby almost threw America officially on the side of the haters of Christianity? The entire story is now public. Public for those who have persisted in lifting the embargo in favor of communism. It was only after all these things had happened and were disclosed that we Christian Americans were forced to object to the planned interference of our country in Spanish affairs. Let me outline for you the basic developments which almost catapulted us into the Spanish War. Developments which, if not checked, will succeed in embroiling us in the impending World War. Some months ago, when the persecution of the Jews in Germany was the chief topic of the day, I had occasion to invite the religious Jews of the United States to join with us in a crusade to end all persecution, both of Jews and of Christians. In making my plea, I was careful to distinguish atheistic Jews from religious Jews. I regretted the callous silence in the press and on the radio, which had permitted the assassination of millions of Christians to go unnoticed. I rejoiced that extraordinary publicity was given to the persecuted Jews in Germany. It was also pointed out that if Jews rightly challenged Christians for their sympathy against Nazi persecution, it was logical for Christians to challenge Jews for theirs against communistic persecution, particularly when so many atheistic Jews had played such prominent parts in the birth and organization of radicalism in Russia. Following these broadcast statements, I became the subject of discussion and the object of attack in every Jewish magazine and in many secular publications. The assertions which I made, namely that Nazism was a defense mechanism set up against communism, and that atheistic Jews were altogether too prominent in the promotion of communism, these assertions were denied. But of most importance, the invitation which I extended to the Jews of America to join officially with the Christians in stamping out communism has gone unheeded. There the case stands. The argument is summed up like this. Father Coughlin asked the Jews of America to join officially with the Christians in stamping out communism only after they had asked the Christians of America to join with the Jews in liquidating the persecutions of Nazism. The Christians did their part. But because certain facts which Father Coughlin used in extending his invitation are not accepted by the Jews, therefore, Jews will not join officially with Christians in opposing communism. That is the way the case stands today in the minds of millions of Americans. It is a case which takes on more significant importance in view of the fact that a multitude of Jews in America have been and still are open supporters for the communist cause in Spain. The case would end if the General Jewish Council, the most important body of Jews in America, were content to abandon it at this point. However, they have seen fit to extend the issue, not only in secular publications and in full-page advertisements, but in a booklet entitled Father Coughlin, which this organization recently published and distributed to the members of the Congress of the United States and to other influential citizens. Not for any personal satisfaction to be gained from argumentation do I take up this challenge to pursue the issue. I am more concerned in having the religious Jews of America commit themselves officially and forcefully against communism, as they have against Nazism, to the end that both Christians and Jews in our country will participate neither with the Nazis nor with the communists in the European war which appears to be inevitable. I am dealing with no abstract problem, I assure you. It is a most concrete reality. Thus, I am of the opinion that unless the Christian Americans are able to enroll the aid and sympathy of the religious Jews to oppose communism as well as Nazism, America eventually will regiment its men, money, and munitions on the side of the communists. For we recognize the tremendous influence which the sons of Jewry wield in the press, the cinema, and the radio, the three chief sources which control public opinion. Unfortunately for all, both Jew and Gentile, we are not united on this proposition of standing aloof from the impending war. Unfortunately for all, there are certain influential Jews in the United States who at this date, as I shall disclose with evidence, are looking towards the day when our country, together with England and France, will throw all their resources against Germany and on the side of the communists, because Adolf Hitler has persecuted the Jews resident in Germany. Permit me to develop this statement. It was November 20th, 1938, when I broadcast the proposal to American Jews to take sides with American Christians in liquidating all persecution. It was only then that I observed that the atrocities committed by the communists against Christians were exceedingly more serious than those suffered by the Jews at the hands of the Nazis. At that time, less than 3 months ago, I also had occasion to observe that the well-publicized persecution of Jews in Germany was remarkable in that not one Jew was put to death officially for his race or religion. In comparison with this, more than 20 million Christians had been done to death under the Trotskys and Bellicoons of communism, both of whom were Jews. 6 months before I made this appeal to the religious Jews of America, I was only one of many Christians who were disturbed by an article which appeared in the American Hebrew magazine, one of the most important Jewish publications in America. Precisely on June 3rd, 1938, an article in this magazine determined the necessity for our bringing into the open not the question of anti-Semitism, but the question of sound Semitism. A Semitism which is perfectly legitimate for all Jews to uphold and perfectly reasonable for all non-Jews to respect. On that date, I was shocked to learn how far-reaching and international in scope the unsound Semitism of certain Jews extended. It was a Semitism which confused race and nationality. Because their co-racials in Germany were suffering from the persecutions of the Nazi government, co-racials and co-religionists who were not co-nationals of the Jews in the United States, I was shocked when certain American Jews entertained the idea that the resources of this and other nations should be employed against the Hitler government on the principle that the entire world should go to war on behalf of German Jews to settle an internal problem in Germany. I asked myself the abstract question. If Irish Roman Catholics were persecuted by the Irish government, would it not be unpatriotic, unsound, and unjust for the Irish Catholics in this nation to propagandize the United States into war against Ireland? While persecution itself must be condemned, the Irish Catholics of America have no right to expect the Protestants and Jews and other racial Catholics of America and the resources of the entire nation to be placed at the disposal of the Irish Catholics in Ireland. For I believe they understand the difference between race and nationality. Then there was a concrete case in Mexico where Catholics actually were persecuted. There was also the concrete case in Germany where Protestants actually were persecuted. Neither Catholic nor Protestant groups in America sought to throw this nation's men, munitions, and money against Mexico or Germany, for we as Americans do not subscribe to such policy. Sound racialism admits that the allegiance of a man is owing to his nation in preference to his race. I now return to the article published in the American Hebrew magazine 6 months before I broadcast upon these subjects. The article referred to stated that the three outstanding leaders in the world today are the three Jews, Leon Blum, the radical of France, Maxim Litvinov, the reddest of red Russians, and Leslie Hoare Belisha, Minister of War in England. The article clearly shows that race is preferred to nationality, at least by its author. From the article, I quote the following quotations. Monsieur Blum, without portfolio, is still an important character in the French political picture. It is likely that Blum will continue to be the one to whom the masses will look for leadership. Maxim Litvinov, Commissar of Foreign Affairs, far outranks any comrade of the international, with the exception of the sallow-complexioned keeper of the Kremlin. Litvinov is the high-pressure gentleman who sold President Roosevelt on recognition of the Soviet government and the establishment of trade agreements. He has accomplished the ultimate in the diplomatic ken by keeping conservative England on the most amicable of terms with Red Russia. The English Jew of prominence, continues the article, is Leslie Hoare Belisha, Secretary of State for War. Though sagacious, and through sagacious use of the public prints, at which he is a past master, having learned his stuff from Lord Beaverbrook, the daddy of all the press lords, he managed to keep his own name prominent. So it may come to pass, concludes the article, that these three sons of Israel, these three Jews, will form the combine that will send the frenzied Nazi dictator to the hell to which he has consigned so many of their kind of people. These forces of reaction are being mobilized. Regardless of the action of the Senate, which will shake him loose from the premiership, Blum, as leader of the strong socialist mass, will continue to have a firm finger in the Parisian political potpourri. Russia, as in the past, continues to look to Maxim Litvinov for her foreign policy. And England, amazed and gratified at the job turned in by her imaginative yet solid war minister, feels a new security in the capable military forces which complement the King's Navy. And when the smoke of battle clears, concludes this article, trumpets no longer blare and bullets have ceased to blast, there may be presented a tableau showing the man who played God, the swastika de Christus, being lowered none too gently into a hole in the ground as the trio of non-Aryans intone a ramified requiem that sounds suspiciously like a medley of the Marseillaise. God Save the King and the Internationale, blending in grand finale into a militant, proud, and aggressive arrangement of Ailey Ailey. Unquote. That is the end of the quotation, which discloses for us, at least inferentially, a worldwide policy advocated not by religious Jews, but by international Jews, to coordinate and regiment the forces of Gentile Christian nations under the leadership of Jews, not only to cast Hitler into hell, but to substitute for the national anthems of the countries concerned, the national anthem of Jewry. This is unsound Semitism, because it fails to place the nationality of Americanism above the racialism of Judaism. Sane Americans, be they Jew or Gentile, are generous with their sympathies for the persecuted wherever they exist. Nevertheless, they will not subscribe to a proposition of hurtling this nation into a war for the internal, religious, or racial difficulties that are extant in other nations. They are opposed to any policy designed to create a world war for the sake of revenging the ill treatment meted out to any Jew or group of Jews resident in Germany or elsewhere, as long as these Jews or groups of Jews are not American citizens or nationals. Were the thoughts contained in the article which I have just quoted privately circulated among the Jews themselves, I would not venture to discuss them publicly. But insofar as they have become publicized in one of the most important Jewish magazines in America, I realized that it was high time to counteract them to the best of my ability, particularly when there was scarcely a Jew of prominence in the entire United States who spoke out in favor of the Christians in Spain or against the irreligious forces of the so-called loyalists marshaled under the red flag. All these things woven together, and particularly the six-month-old publication of this boast to inflict a world war upon all nations to satisfy a personal racial revenge against Hitler, a world war in which the three chief nations of Europe will be dominated by Jewish rulers. All these things certainly demanded of those who are cognizant of them to take whatsoever action was necessary to prevent the realization of this author's dream. Thus, if the Spanish question was made an American question by those who exercise so much control over the press, the radio, and the cinema, and the question in favor of the communists, it was our business to counteract it. For if Spain had fallen into the hands of the leftists, it were only a matter of weeks until Delage's government in France would have given over to the Jewish radical gloom. It were only a matter of weeks until the peaceful Chamberlain would have been forced into retirement with Paul Belisha holding the reins of authority in England. It were only a matter of weeks until the dream of the author of the article in the American Hebrew magazine would have been realized. Must the entire world go to war for 600,000 German Jews who are not American, British, French, Polish, Russian, or Mexican, or any other nationality citizens outside of being German citizens? Must unsound racialism be permitted to destroy the sound principles of nationalism? I am indifferent to the attacks which the General Jewish Council is busied in formulating against me. In their recent publication, entitled Father Coughlin, I shall gladly welcome any personal humiliation which I am asked to endure, as long as I can contribute anything to destroy the international complex, the world war complex, either in behalf of the communists or in behalf of the Nazis. Let Germany and Russia fight their own battles. Let Nazism and communism engage in their own wars. This is America, dedicated to the principle of no foreign entanglement, an America where race must be subordinated to nationality. The case as I have presented it stands on record. While individual Jews, to their credit, have castigated communism and upheld Americanism, the nation is still waiting for an official condemnation of communism by the most representative body of Jews known as the General Jewish Council, which is composed of the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, the B'nai B'rith, and the Jewish Labor Committee. 4 years ago, on October 29, 1935. We Christian Americans who have opportunity to read radical literature in order to study trends, we were surprised at another article which appeared in the leftist magazine, The New Masses, a Jewish-controlled publication. The article referred to was written by James Waterman Wise, son of Rabbi Stephen S. Wise. This gentleman, aroused because individual Jews of prominence had issued public statements against communism, wrote the following amazing paragraph, quotation. "Jews are not communists," is the burden of a panic-stricken statement issued jointly by Dr. Cyrus Adler, Alfred M. Cohen, and B. C. Vladeck. These gentlemen hysterically deny that communism is Jewish and frenziedly repudiate Jews who are communists. Their statement, concocted out of fear for themselves, libels our Soviet Russia and lies about the Jewish people. Behind high-flown phrases lies a poorly veiled invitation to potential Nazis of America to pogromize Jews. Let us analyze their statement," continues Mr. Wise. "They first attempt to show that the Jews of Germany and of other countries are not and were not communists. And then, that communism and the Soviet Union are themselves foes of Jews and Judaism. Of Soviet Russia, the statement says, among the 36 commissars who constitute Soviet Russia, only two are Jews. Is it possible that the heads of the American Jewish Committee, the B'nai B'rith and the Jewish Labor Committee," continues Mr. Wine, "have never heard of Litvinov, of Yaroslavsky, Kaganovich, Radek, Belakun? Jews who deny that many Jews are communists are jockeying themselves into the position of citizens of toleration," says the son of the eminent Rabbi Stephen F. Wise. "Will not the gentleman," continues he, "will not the gentleman who today disclaim Jewish communists tomorrow disclaim Jewish socialists? Ultimately, these super patriots will deem worthy Americans only such Jews as have wormed their way into fascist organizations and vigilante groups. That the authors of this piece of perfidy do not represent the masses of American Jews," concludes Mr. Wine, "will be made abundantly clear. To counteract its poison and to preclude its repetition, Jews must take active and positive measures. There must be a widening and strengthening of the united front against fascism. And if by taking full part in the forging of this united front, the Jews of America write themselves down as communists, so be it," unquote. Waterman Wise. Patriotism or nationalism, according to this prominent view, must give way to racialism and internationalism. Since last November, two phases of our discussion on these subjects have been under consideration. I refer to the persecution phase of Jews and of Christians, and to the lifting of the Spanish embargo. Neither has been terminated as we enter upon the third and the most important. The third phase deals with the question, shall the United States become embroiled in a world war on the side of either Nazism or communism? The answer to the question is of such vast importance to the youth of this nation, to their parents, to the future of our country, yes, and to the rise or fall of civilization itself, that no effort may be spared to answer it according to American principles. Therefore, we not only welcome the cooperation of the religious Jews of America, We plead for it. We plead for it. In order to keep America out of a war in which it has no good reason to enter, other than a trumped-up commercial reason or a fictitious diplomatic reason, the real reason, that of becoming the policeman of the world to protect race minorities whenever they find themselves in disagreement with their national governments, that reason is never disclosed. The burden of my theme has been and will continue to be the leaguing together of all Americans, be they Jew or Gentile, against all persecution wherever it exists. But in doing so, I do not support the theory that this nation of ours should risk its future and destroy its democracy by permitting itself to fight the battles of any persecuted religious or race minority outside our nation, or of entering as a partisan into the internal struggle of any foreign powers. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a multitude of tasks to perform at home and little time to expend on problems abroad, particularly when meddling with these problems begets ill will and ill feeling for the United States. There's the domestic problem of trade. According to the Washington Star, we read that our monthly trade with South America, Central America, West Indies, and Mexico during the first 11 months of 1938 averaged only about one half of that of 1929. Meanwhile, European trade to these countries has increased beyond ours. Then there's the problem of forced idleness, which I discussed last Sunday. More than 10 million laborers and 20 million toasters, together with all the industrialists of our nation, are clamoring for a solution of unemployment. Then there's the problem, the complex problem of agriculture. God knows when that will be settled. It will never be settled as long as we entertain the heresy of curtailing crops, of plowing under cotton, and at the same time of importing our foodstuffs from foreign countries. Meanwhile, in the spirit of race revenge, we disregard these problems and prefer to entertain a policy of boycotting Germany, formerly the greatest importer of American cotton and certain other American products. On this point, permit me to read you a letter which the non-sectarian Anti-Nazi League to Champion Human Rights Incorporated addressed to the Compressed Yeast Corporation of America. That is a rather lengthy title, this non-sectarian anti-Nazi League to Champion Human Rights Incorporated. But the letter has to do with our subject. This organization was founded by the eminent Jew Samuel Untermeyer. Its chairman of the board of directors is Dr. S. William Kalb. The letter which the self-styled League to Champion Human Rights Incorporated addressed to the Compressed Yeast Corporation reads as follows. Gentlemen, as you are probably aware, the name of your firm is at present among those listed in our monthly publication, the Anti-Nazi Bulletin, as handling merchandise imported from Germany. Since thousands of the members and friends of our organization throughout the country turn to our bulletin for information regarding those who are giving economic support to the Nazi regime by carrying on trade with Germany, we publish such names in every issue. According to our present information, your firm continues to deal in German goods. And we, therefore, believe ourselves justified in continuing to place you on our list. However, in order to make certain that we are absolutely fair to you, we take this occasion to request any statement that you may wish to make before the forthcoming issue of our publication goes to press, which will be within the next few days. Very truly yours, the Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League, signed Leo Spanglet, Research Division, MB. Nazi Germany is the enemy of civilization. Refuse to trade with the enemy. Unquote letter. You will observe that while this league is anti-Nazi, it is not anti-communist. While it stamps Germany as the enemy of civilization, its silence infers that Russia is a friend of civilization. But more worthy of observation is the disclosure that the Jewish gentlemen who hold high office in this non-sectarian anti-Nazi league advocate a policy of boycotting Germany by intimidating every American importer who trades with Germany. This pro-communist, pro-racial propaganda must be checkmated, not in the interests of Germany, but in the interests of the United States. Were it permitted to proceed to its logical conclusion, the Irish, English, Poles, Germans, and other American racial minorities constantly would force us into serious trouble with all foreign nations by setting up boycotts. Up to date, Germany has not injured the persons of American citizens, although it has persecuted Catholic, Protestant, and Jews. Mexico, our next-door communist neighbor, has been notorious for injuring American citizens. It has confiscated their oil wells and their property. But no protest from this organization that styles itself the League to Champion Human Rights has been forthcoming in this instance. If certain American corporations are intimidated through threatening letters to cease trading abroad, what would the officers of this anti-Nazi league conclude if we Christian Americans had recourse to this vile, unsportsmanlike, un-American method toward those who import either goods or ideas from Russia, towards those who export to the communists either financial or moral support for their cause? All behind the silken glove of these so-called human rights is the mailed fist of human hatred, which grasps a poisoned arrow. Shot from the bowstring of boycott, this arrow will inflict untold damage upon the 68 million Catholics and Protestants resident in Germany, who are as guiltless of the activities of the Nazi Party as are we in these United States. Meanwhile, as a result of boycott, American commerce suffers, American workmen are dispossessed of their jobs, American cotton farmers languish for trade, while we citizens permit ourselves to be enveloped by a complex of racial revenge. The appearance of anti-Semitism in America is to be deprecated now and forevermore. Every American must work towards the liquidation of all anti-racialism. But in doing so, we should remember that we are Americans, though we be Catholic or Protestant or Jew, of Irish, of English, of Hebraic, or of any other racial descent. We should remember that our American nationality takes precedence over our racial origin. We should remember that in this country, while freedom of conscience and of religion is guaranteed to every citizen, That freedom may not be exploited by any racial group to the end that all Americans will become embroiled in a world war, either to destroy Hitler or Stalin, either to defend Catholic or Protestant or Jew, as such in any other country of the world outside the United States of America. Why leave our own? Asked George Wharton. Or may I ask, is this our own? Is this country, this nation, a private domain of any race? And we its citizens, their subjects? Therefore I plead with the religious Jews of America, who entertain sound notions of Semitism, to oppose the radicals in their midst who would exploit them and through them this country. The so-called organization of the Anti-Nazi League to Champion Human Rights Incorporated should begin championing the rights of the Jews in America by judicious action instead of inviting disaster upon them through the partiality which they manifest towards the communist nations. They should recognize that they who deal in a program of boycott or intimidation are surely dealing with a double-edged sword. Let hatred be the only object of boycott in this fair land of ours. If we must hate, let us hate hate. In doing so, let us distinguish between radical policies upheld by the governments abroad and the patient populations thereof. As much as we are out of tune and tempo with the program of Stalin and his commissars, we American Christians look behind the veil of his government and visualize the 160 million Russians who are neither Roman Catholic nor Protestant, but Greek Catholic Christians. We recognize that these persons would be the ultimate sufferers of any boycott which we Christians in America might organize against Russia. Therefore, in conscience, we may not favor any pagan policy of boycotting the innocent victims of Stalin's rule in Russia. And so with the Jews of America. If they are intelligent and religious, and I believe great numbers of them are, they may not permit themselves to be regimented by factional, injudicious, super-racial leaders who are attempting to inflict the lash of economic persecution upon the backs of 68 million German Protestants and Catholics, and thereby add to the sufferings which already this victimized people experiences. Ladies and gentlemen, copies of this address will be mailed gladly to all who write to me this week. In the meantime, may I thank those of you who at your own personal inconvenience brought many letters of welcome to our office last week, asking me to mail you regularly copies of Social Justice Magazine, the magazine that has told the truth fearlessly and will continue to tell the truth on these and on other subjects. Thus, after the Little Flower Choristers will have sung for you the Benedictus, I will return to the microphone in 3 minutes. permit me to spend the remaining minutes at my disposal mentioning not Social Justice Magazine, of which I am editor, but Time Magazine. In this week's Social Justice Magazine, I wrote an article commenting upon a recent industrial conference held at Detroit under the jurisdiction of Archbishop Mooney. Incidentally, I joined with every right-minded citizen in applauding the statements made by His Excellency in favor of the laboring man. Curious to learn the reaction which Time Magazine had towards the conference, I searched through its January 30th issue and discovered the following literary gem. Time Magazine says, "One of the great United States Catholic leaders, Detroit Archbishop Edward Mooney, warned the conferees that religious leaders in the present struggle between Americanism and communism for the control of labor must make Christian principles articulate, or they will have to share their responsibility in the debacle that ensues. Next day, to make his own principles articulate, Archbishop Mooney summoned all the 542 priests of his archdiocese, including one whose parish work is something of a sideline and whose love for labor is not great, the Reverend Charles Edward Silo Charlie Coghlan, so nicknamed because his charity crucifixion tower reminds many Detroiters of a silo," unquote. Thus, Time Magazine, which has never campaigned for labor, is readily forgiven for its inaccuracy when it says that my love for labor is not great. My record on that point was secure even before Time Magazine was born in 1923. But it is not forgiven for directly insulting the hundreds of thousands of Catholics and Protestants who made possible a charity crucifixion tower. It is not forgiven for indirectly insulting the crucified Christ whose monument is described by Time as a silo. By inference, are we Catholics and Protestants who receive our spiritual food and drink from the victim of the cross? Are we cattle, content to fill ourselves with silage? By printing such classical billingsgate, Time has stubbed its editorial toes against eternity. I believe that there are hundreds of thousands in this audience, both Catholics and Protestants, who resent this flood of intellectual and moral filth designed to destroy Christianity. I believe that in this day of desecration of patriotism, and desecration of religion, those who rejoice in the name of Christians are willing to pledge their talents and their services to Christ to preserve Americanism and Christianity from attacks originating both from within and from without our nation. Christ, the crucified Christ, is the Prince of Peace. His cross will always remain the pulpit of charity. There he hangs today as of yesteryear, preaching a sermon to all mankind, pleading with us to forgive our enemies, for they know not what they do. Among the priceless possessions at the shrine of the little flower is a small piece of the true cross upon which Christ was crucified, a souvenir which was sent to me by the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem. Perhaps it means nothing to you. Perhaps it means much. But presuming that hundreds of thousands in this audience would be glad to possess a beautiful metal crucifix, presuming that each one of you would be glad to carry this symbol of your Christianity in your pocket or purse, a symbol to which I've touched the relic of the true cross, I offer on this occasion of desecration to send as a gift to each person in this audience who holds his patriotism, his Americanism, and his Christianity in high esteem, yes, to every person willing to die for them, I offer to send to each one of you this souvenir, this symbol of our faith, this sign of our salvation, and this reminder of our Christian obligation. Let the cross be your inspiration instead of the symbol of the swastika or the symbol of the sickle and hammer. Therefore, to all who write a letter to me this week, I will be glad to mail one of these precious crucifixes, which in one sense will bind us all together as we march forward for God, for country, for peace and prosperity. A symbol that will give us courage to fight those relentlessly who would embroil us in another carnage of destruction. Kindly address your letters directly to me at Royal Oak, Michigan. Good afternoon, and God bless you, my friend.
Ladies and gentlemen, the beautiful metallic crucifixes that Father Coughlin has offered everyone in this audience are free for the asking. However, to expedite the work in the office, please ask for only one crucifix in each letter. Whether or not you can afford to contribute towards the expenses entailed in this project makes little difference. Please remember, one crucifix per letter. Write your name plainly and address your letter directly to Reverend Charles E. Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Until next Sunday afternoon at this same time, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
We've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin,
from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and in no way reflect the policies of this station.
WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.